Well, we were probably somewhere around 38 or 41 or something in there. Okay. So I think the last thing we did was, there was, of the numerous compromises that existed, there was a compromise made to, for the selection of the presidency, and that compromise was that neither the Congress or individual voters of the states would select the president, but rather the state legislators would do so. And not to leave you to point too long, because I know you want to hear the numbers and the reviews, and I'll have you ready. But did I talk a little bit about the Florida circumstance?
No.
Well, one of the, a textbook textbook case of what could happen is the 2000 election. And what's kind of interesting in that election, if you recall from it, it came down to a situation where Gore decided to contest three counties because he thought the vote was so close it fell within the Florida law margin that if it's like that small of a percentage, a candidate, if they do the proper channels, can request a recount. The Gore camp, looking back, felt that if they'd asked for a recount of all 60 counties, while it would have made even more people mad at the start, it probably would have gone through legally. But by choosing only three counties, that became a problem later. He felt like he possibly won in those three counties. And the reason that it became a problem later is because the Florida courts, in a ruling, said count all 60 counties, which was not the original suit he took out. And that's where the Bush camp was able to fight it in the Supreme Court after them. But regardless of whether Bush, I mean, Gore had ever gotten the count he wanted, or the counting done, I should say, the legislature of Florida was dominated by Republicans, and they made a claim all along that regardless of which way the count comes up, they could, if they so wish, which something they were going to do, award all the electoral votes to the Republican candidate, regardless of the Florida popular vote. And that surprised many. People thought it wasn't legal. But the way the Constitution set up is the state legislature can choose the electors, and there's no limits on when it can choose the electors. States can choose for themselves how they want to go through that process, and about 24 states have laws saying electors have to follow the will of the public vote. 26 are, they can choose as they wish. But in the rare occasions in the past where even the states have had an obligatory popular selection of the electors, there have been a few faithless electors that have chosen Mao Zedong and Mickey Mouse and things like that, and those people have never been arrested for casting the vote elsewhere. So what that really means is that had Gore got the vote he wanted, the legislature could have legally still given Bush to Florida, because that's the way the Constitution set it up for the state legislature. They indicated and hinted they would. Who knows what would have happened with public media pressure on them. But in looking at that, it's kind of, what's the purpose of setting it up that way? Well, we know it's to avoid popular vote and congressional control, but why the creation of electoral college in that fashion? There's a purpose we all forget, because as a nation, after 200 something years, we just kind of, this doesn't seem to be as big a thing.
Fear of tyranny.
Fear of tyranny over the states. The fear that a federal government would take away state authority. So what the Electoral College's intention was, and still serves to do, is to protect states' involvement in the presidential selection. So if you're watching the electoral maps every 4 years and you say to yourself, there's something kind of crazy going on here, if you say to yourself, the polls that show what percentage of voters would go for which aren't really something you can trust, because we have to wait and see how the states unfold. Yes, that's exactly how it's going. You're not looking at one election. You're looking at 51 elections, 50 states and D.C., and how that lines up. And that's on purpose, to set it up so that the states have that much of a significant role. It may seem to us now to not be fair or popular vote or whatever, but fairness or popular representation was not their intent. State representation is the intent of electoral college.
What's the purpose of the popular vote doesn't really...
Well, because it does to a degree. The only time it doesn't is when it comes close like that. But generally speaking, the parties made an agreement back in the 1830s during the Jackson years that they've kind of held to ever since, that whoever wins the plurality of the popular vote automatically gets all the electors of the given state, whether by law or whether by tradition. And the only reason it broke down in this case is because it was so close and got legally...
Right, but I mean, there's been states in this last election. In 2004, we heard that the popular vote is for one party, but the other party won't stay.
So therefore, if you
you may have something in mind, I don't readily remember that being the case. My understanding is that, well, the way I've studied it is that whoever wins the plurality of the popular vote gets all the electors. And there's a difference between plurality and majority. What's that difference?
States never did pay taxes to the federal government.
Majority means what?
Over
50%. I hear somebody talking out down here. I think one of these is not recording. I'm having echoes of me. It's like a Star Trek episode. This one here? Possibly none of them.
No, I'm here.
You hear three? Yes, this is me talking. That was so strange. So whoever has the orange one is playing, not recording. But that may be your wish. So should be waiting to stop gabbing and circle the numbers. By the way, the plurality thing arrangement is set up so that, say, for instance, three candidates run. A good case example is 1992, if you remember the 92 election. Did we do this one yet? Yeah, that one was really wild, because in the spring of 92, Perot was on, whose show was it? It was on Larry King Live, and Larry King Live made some comment to the effect of, if you think you could do better, have you ever thought about running for president? And he said, yes, I'll announce right now I'm running. It's on Larry King Live, so he made his announcement. And he immediately shot up in the polls past both Clinton and Bush the elder and stayed ahead of them in popular polls all the way until July, which brought up all these interesting questions. If generally speaking, only the two major parties win because it's winner take all on the electoral vote. And the state's set up so that theoretically if somebody got 35 to 33 to 32%, the 35%er gets all the electors and the other two get nothing. So that's why the big winners always get all the electors and the third-party people get no electors at all. But in this case, Perot, the non-party person, was ahead in all the popular polls, which gave this question to rise. Will the old party apparatus still stay in place and support Bush and Clinton, and Perot will get squeezed out? Or will enough popular vote swinging over, giving plurality votes for state by state, mean that in theory, in good spirit of the arrangement, he should get all the electors of the state? The trouble is he has no party and no slate of electors waiting to cast for it. So then the next question would be, well, it's possible that if some sharp, ahead of the curve people saw this, they could say, I quit the Republicans, I quit the Democrats, I'm joining Perot's camp, and they could come up with an overnight party suddenly and then cast all those electoral votes, and then they would be in power, and then they could, within another 2 or 4 years, I may be controlling Congress. All that was very feasibly possible. As I watched this unfold, I thought, wow, this is going to be the greatest thing to teach. It's wonderful. And then you remember what happened? Suddenly Perot jumps out of the race during the Democratic convention, claiming first, the Democrats seem to be getting their act together. And when asked if that meant he's supporting Clinton, he said, no, I'm not. Second, my daughter's getting married, and Bush, who hates me, has the FBI harassing my daughter's wedding. And he was out. And then in August he was back in, but not really. So what would have happened if he had stayed in and not kind of gone strange there on us?
He was kind of a lesser of two.
I think he could have won. Or at least I think he could have gotten the popular vote plurality in enough states to should have been the winner. Now whether or not we had like Florida, a bunch of state legislatures trying to work out casting our votes here anyway, but all that would have been possible. But we still got a lot of fun in 2000. So. I can say that now. It wasn't so easy to say that.
What's up with that happened in 2008?
Well, the fact that it's so close in 2004, I'm kind of hoping it's like a political storm season that never stops, that it's always close and close and close, and there's always something magical to teach after that. Another compromise related to the executive branch was the vice presidency. We know the purpose of the vice president today is what? Be ready to take office upon resignation or death of the president. And that was made law in 1793 and then made even more firmly law through an amendment ratified in 1965. But in the very beginning of the Constitutional Convention, it wasn't even envisioned that the vice president would become the president. It was kind of understood that they would temporarily take over in case the president happened to die or leave, but not with conferring the title upon them. that when that first happened in 1841, John Tyler claimed he was the president and had ceremonies to swear himself in, and members of his own party were going around claiming you're not officially the president, you're just acting and functioning. But he pulled it off well enough that it kind of became accepted that way. So if it wasn't to become the president, what was the purpose? What is the constitutional purpose given the vice president? At least the
leader of the House.
Leader of the Senate, presides over the Senate, even if it's usually ceremonious rather than functional. And there is actually an additional power in the Senate that the vice president has.
Cast the deciding vote.
Yes. If there is a tie, then they cast a tie-breaking vote, which is why back when the Republicans and the Democrats had 50-50 seats after 2000, still more fun from that election.
Mm-hmm.
Since committee chairpersonships go to the majority party, there were Democrats, like myself, claiming, hey, there is no majority party, it's 50-50, and then there were people saying, if it came down to a nasty vote tie-break every single time, Cheney could break every tie, and therefore we are the majority party, and it went that way. So that casting the tie-breaking vote. Of course, things had a bit of a comeuppance, if you remember that, when this Jeffries, a Republican from Vermont, he went independent. So he didn't necessarily become a Democrat, he just became a neither, leaving it 49-50. But that's how Daschle got to be Senate Majority Leader for a while. So the selection of the Vice President, that was the purpose of the Vice President, but the selection process was also a compromise in this sense. They set it up in the very beginning that the electors, when they cast their votes, they cast their vote for two different presidential choices. And whoever gets the majority of the electoral votes becomes president, and whoever comes in second becomes vice president, with this restriction on the voting. They can't cast, the electors cannot cast both their votes for candidates from the same state. The 12th Amendment came along later and adjusted it and changed it to where electors cast one vote specifically for a president and specifically for a vice president, and the two winners can't come from the same state. So it's carrying on the same intention as the original setup. What's the purpose there?
So no one state controls.
The belief in balance, that either north and south or small state, large state, east, west, something, that there would be not the whole executive branch controlled getting benefits to one state only.
So there's never going to be a state vice president from the same state during the election?
Right now there is. But there's an explanation for that. Cheney owns more property in Texas than he does in Wyoming. And that was challenged by the Democrats at the re-election 2004 time. And the courts ruled that even if he owned more property in Texas, his original residence in Wyoming and enough property there constitutes, he can claim that as his residence by choice. So that's in the 1968 election, Nixon was going to take Nelson Rockefeller as his running mate, until they figured out that Nixon's property holdings in New York were so much more so than California, that there could be an argument that they're both from New York. So he just didn't think of New York as a running.
How did they get Rockefeller as governor in Arkansas?
How did we?
Yeah, I mean, that's the name
from Long Winthrop Rockefeller moved a long, long time ago, like before the 50s, I think, into Arkansas, with the intent of helping develop the state, which he did do so. So, elected in the 60s as governor. But he is brother to Nelson, vice president. Okay, where are we on the sheet here? Functions of the president. The civilian commander of the military, or control of the military, we talked about that already from the Declaration of Independence. The president has the authority to either veto laws or sign them into law. Two types of vetoes. There is the pocket veto and I guess normal veto. Pocket veto is where if within a 10-day period during a session a president does not move on a bill, it becomes law without signature. I just lied. ignore all that. That was a rehearsal. Here's the truth. If a bill does what I just said, it becomes law. If a bill is at the last 10 days of a session when Congress closes session and the president sits on it, then it's a veto, it dies. It dies in the end, it becomes law in the middle. Neither on the test, so don't worry about it. But while we're on this, the purpose of a president not vetoing a bill and letting it become law without a signature, why not just sign it into law?
form of protest.
It is. It's a form of protest showing whichever constituency he's trying to impress that he wasn't, even though he wasn't nervy enough to veto it, he disapproves of it.
I can see that I would fail a veto vote, so
a lot of
I'm going to let it go.
Nuanced signals are going
but
on.
But even if he vetoes it, can it not somehow...
Oh yeah, I should have said that for Congress. That if a veto takes place, and if the Congress by a two-thirds vote wishes to make it law over his veto, they can do that. And we will, in our course, when we get to the very end, talking about the post-Civil War period, the first time that happens is Reconstruction bills that Johnson vetoes and they pass over his veto. What's the point? That's true. Well, in veto politics, both presidential and the legislative branches are counting their votes way ahead of time to see if they can sustain a veto or overturn a veto. And lots of times, if one knows they have the power to do the other, then that is a bargaining chip before the bill ever gets out of the Congress to start with. Appointments. The president has the authority to make judicial, ambassadorial, and cabinet appointments, and as we know, of course, with Senate confirmation. And then the president is given the responsibility of carrying out the laws, although there have been times when people like Nixon refused to spend money appropriated for certain bills because something that he did veto, that they did override the veto, became a spending bill despite his discontent, and so he figured by sitting on the money and not spending it, that would be the same as preventing the bill from going into action, to which Congress passed another law saying it's illegal to do that in hopes that could be the grounds for impeachment. Watergate came before all that could happen. 41, the judicial branch. I think I alluded to this earlier, but the creation of the Supreme Court and then the leaving of most of the rest of the authority of, or the powers of the branches and the different levels of branches were left to Congress to create as a form of compromise to leave power in the hands of Congress. The Supreme Court is the highest court of appeals. There are two occasions where a case can start in the Supreme Court. One is when states sue each other, and the other is when American diplomats overseas are tried for crimes. Their case starts in the Supreme Court, since they have diplomatic immunity overseas. One of the most significant powers of the Supreme Court, which we will talk historically about later, how it came to be, is that of judicial review. Although not provided for in the Constitution, it was a traditional power of courts to be able to deem a law unconstitutional. In our situation, when a Supreme Court deems a law unconstitutional, they have to show chartered explanations as to how it violates what part of the document. In English law, just overturning any law is considered judicial review that is legal, and that's what makes the English Constitution uniquely different than ours. 42, the amendment process. There are two ways that amendments, this is Article 5, two ways that amendments can be proposed and two ways they can be ratified. The way that every amendment has been proposed so far is for it to come out of two-thirds of both houses of Congress. Hypothetically, or legally, I guess, it's possible that another way amendment could be proposed is for two-thirds of the states to hold a convention to propose an amendment or many amendments. And I guess the last time that happened, they overthrew the government, the art of the Federation of Created Constitution, so maybe there's a little hesitancy to use that method. Ratification, and I always forget this number. I say three-fourths, then I think three-fifths, and then someone usually corrects me and says three-fourths, so I'm going to think it's three-fourths. But three-fourths of the state's legislatures ratify an amendment in the same written form, then it's constitutional. Or if three-fourths of the states hold ratifying conventions of a document in the same written form. That second format has been used one time only. What would be the one you'd most likely assume state conventions rather than legislatures would be turned to?
Civil War.
That's one you might think, but it actually wasn't that. What's the kind of thing that you cannot go back and face the voters with either way, saying you voted on? If that was one, that would have been one. That was kind of the guess we were working on there, the controversy over civil rights. But that one wasn't really that bad because northern states had their thumb on southern states and forced them to have to ratify if they were going to come back to the Union. It's letting people drink again.
prohibition.
Yeah, the repeal of prohibition is the one that was too politically hot for legislators to face their voters, so they left it to conventions of people who do not have to run for reelection. So that's the amendment process. 43. People who favored the ratification of the Constitution took on the term Federalists, and those who opposed it were called Anti-Federalists. The Anti-Federalists, and by the way, this will be the basis of two political parties later, it's misleading because after these two political parties come into existence, there is a Constitution, neither is Anti-Constitution, but they're the leftover people who stood one way or the other on this. Anti-Federalists more often than not included small farmers, especially Western debtors. But they also included people who just ideologically had the feeling that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, as the British writer Lord Acton would say. And those people included like Sam Adams, Patrick Henry, and John Hancock, who just felt like that the kind of a beard theory, that this was some kind of conspiracy by the top elite to take away the liberty of the people, that it was a counter-revolution. Hancock changed his mind on this. Sam Adams and Patrick Henry never did. They never gave their approval or complimented the Constitution. But Hancock was approached by influential people from Massachusetts who said, you know, in the scheme of what's being created here, we all know who the first president's going to be. It's going to be Washington. It has to be. He's the only one everybody trusts. He can unite people. And he's from Virginia or the South, so we're going to need some kind of northern New England politician to be the vice president. And you know, John, you'd really make a great vice president if you were for the Constitution. So he said, with that approach given, Hancock switched from opposition to ratification, helped move the fight along in Massachusetts so that it was ratified, and sure enough, after it was ratified, a Massachusetts vice president did come in with Washington, John Adams. Anti-Federalists, or in the beginning Anti-Federalists who later changed their mind, had a great complaint saying that it's still too dangerous, it's still too powerful of a document, there needs to be a national Bill of Rights added. Well, James Madison, who had been instrumental in most of the writing and the creating and then agonized at every turn of the step of a compromise. He was very upset about the creation of the Senate. He didn't like the watering down of the powers of the federal government. He felt, Madison, that he had come up with the perfect balanced government, especially with the creation of federal and state and the three branches. So there was no need for a Bill of Rights. He also just didn't want to do it. It wasn't just an insult. It was kind of like, this is all said and done. Why are we at this point? And people said, well, we just won't do it. We just can't muster the vote in the states to ratify unless you come up with a Bill of Rights. So he tried another ploy. He said, well, if you make a Bill of Rights, first he says the states all have Bills of Rights, that's sufficient. And that was shot down in a hurry, the fact that states' Bills of Rights would only contain state power. And if you're going to have national supremacy, you've got to have national supremacy checks. So then he said, okay, how about this? If you list your rights and forget some, don't you run the risk of admitting that you've given them up and lost them? So therefore, wouldn't it be wiser not to list them, and therefore it's understood you still have them? Then I don't have to write one. To which the people said, excellent suggestion. When you build the Bill of Rights, add one in there that says, whatever we forgot, we still have. And that's the Ninth Amendment. If you look on the very last page of our material, where it says, in fact, let me read to you from the book what it says. Because it's a really great amendment. It gives rise to all kinds of potential controversy. Is there a ghost swirling ahead? Okay. I thought it maybe me again. This is here. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. There's a couple of things I want to comment while we're on this, and that is, what are the others? What are rights that are not necessarily enumerated, but they're still retained? Is there a right of privacy? Well, where in our first few amendments is privacy ever mentioned? It's not. It's alluded to in the search and seizure concepts about persons, papers, and things, but it doesn't say precisely privacy, which is kind of what there was of the John Roberts question they were on to him about that. To what degree does he understand through the Ninth Amendment that privacy is a given right?
We have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
From where do we get that? You're right, we do, but we're, if someone said, that's not constitutional, you can say, oh yes it is, because... Common law. You just use that common law, which is the English Constitution. We talked about that earlier. So it is a heritage that we grew up with, but if our document is precise and it's not listed, then that's the criticism that we may lose all our common law unless, as the Ninth says, others. So it's considered from the Ninth one of those ones commonly accepted. Privacy. Innocent until proven guilty. The right to travel about without being harassed for documentation papers from county to county. What about abortion? Well, we don't talk about that. But that's what I'm getting at, is that sometimes you can get into some really tricky issues with the Ninth Amendment, and I don't know if the Founding Fathers realized that, or probably did realize that, and I think said that's somebody else's responsibility to fight it out. We need a document to get ratified here. And the Tenth Amendment is also very useful, because it claims powers not delegated. And there's a difference between rights and powers. I always get kind of rankled when I hear the phrase states' rights. People have rights. States have powers. See, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Now here's a kind of a, may seem like a no matter, but it was a great matter to Madison when he wrote it. In Article 9 he says, rights are retained by the people, powers are reserved to the states. Why the different prepositions? That's it. If something is retained by, that means that's where it starts. So people always had those rights. They're not given by government, they're reserved. But powers, from this explanation, our states don't have powers. They have to receive them from sovereigns, people being the sovereigns. So that's, again, where Madison says, I have to write these Bill of Rights. I want to re-stress this we the people concept being the sovereigns. So that was built in there. And that was the debate in the Senate floor many times in the 1830s and 40s. Over anti-slavery bills and tariffs, about whether states had rights and powers, and whether they were they given by the people of the day, or the source of origin of sovereignty. Okay, so now we're on to 44 is not on the test, but that's understood. These would be the people who are more likely going to favor a strong central government. 45, Delaware was the first state to ratify. New Hampshire was the ninth, thus making Article 7 in effect. But the three states listed next to 45 here, Massachusetts, Virginia, North Carolina, were the most vociferously outspoken about we won't ratify until a Bill of Rights is promised. In fact, Massachusetts and Virginia went with the promise. North Carolina remained out of the Union until after the first sessions of Congress put forth the Bill of Rights. New York was another state that had a divided public. And for some, you might say it was like the opposite of Rhode Island. Rhode Island, by the way, was the last state to ratify. Rhode Island said they wanted no part of it. Don't even try to talk them into it. And all the other states, when they were on board, told Rhode Island that if you don't join the Union, we will have a permanent economic boycott upon you forever. So that's what got Rhode Island going. Because they were so small, they thought they would lose all their sovereignty. New York was hesitant to join for kind of the opposite reason. Because they were growing so large and anticipated, and it's a good anticipation, that the population of New York City would grow so large, they might be as large as most of the rest of the country, so why should they have to surrender their will? But for the sake of getting New York in, there were some prominent New Yorkers involved, and their names are listed here. Alexander Hamilton, future Treasury Secretary. John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the Court, and Madison, who's done so much before. Here's a thing I forgot to mention. I know I forgot this, but I should say it. When I was talking about the secrecy and the press ban, I think I mentioned that. Did I mention that the only knowledge that we had of the proceedings were Madison himself kept personal diary notes? during the convention meetings, they were kind of like minutes kept, but they ended up not being minutes revealed. They stayed his own private personal diary recollections that were not released until 1830 after he died. So whatever we had in terms of what happened at that convention up until 1830 was just the hearsay of those who were there rather than any other record, and that record remained until his death. So is it feasible to assume that if historians then jumped on the diary and tried to reconstruct the convention from that, that Madison may have put, and then again I saved the convention, and then again I proposed this? I would do that if I was Madison. I would have myself centrally involved in things like this. I think he may get more credit than he actually is historically deserving. But anyway, these three authors, Hamilton, Jay, and Madison, cooked up a scheme on how to persuade New York to ratify that the Constitution. What they figured out was, we need a letters to the editor campaign. So they collectively wrote letters under one name, Publius, Roman meaning for the public. And they were kind of like those info commercials, where they look like fact, but it's all kind of biased. So they would start off saying, a candid look at how the new executive branch would affect New Yorkers, and it's all positive. Or a critical examination of the value of a national judiciary for New Yorkers, and it's all positive. So it was all a praise. Now, these came to be known as the Federalist Papers and are collected up in volumes along with other documents like the Declaration and Constitution. They're looked back at quite often for a guide to know what were the intent of the original Founding Fathers. But I don't think they so much reflect the intent of the original Founding Fathers. They are a piece of propaganda salesmanship for persuading New York. When Clinton was undergoing impeachment and there was some real question as to what kind of behaviors are impeachable, they went to one of the Federalist Papers, I think 78, written by Hamilton, to see what he claimed, because he wrote about what could be considered impeachable offenses. And at the time he wrote that, he was carrying on a very lurid illicit affair when he wrote it, so I don't know if that's the irony of all that. Madison's Federalist number 10 is probably the one that's studied the most, remembered the most among the group. Here's the reason for it. Madison argued, it is traditional to think that a government centralized far away endangers liberty, and that local government is more in your hands and therefore protects your freedom. But he argued, if you look at most local governments, state governments and local governments, there are elements or factions, as he called it, that can exert disproportionate control over policymaking, much more so than at a national level. So as he called it, the mischief of factions, or what we would call it, special interest groups, exert a much greater degree of control at the local level than at the national level. We could probably name some churches and businesses in Fort Smith that fit exactly the model that Madison's talking about. But they wouldn't have near as much power, well, some might, like Walmart, but they wouldn't have near as much power at the national level. So what Madison was arguing was that with so many different factions or interest groups nationally, at a national level, they'd have to learn to cooperate rather than one or two dominate the rest. Therefore, just by the necessity of cooperation and compromise, people's liberties would be protected by a larger centralized government than they would by local or state. That's very debatable, but that's the one that Madison is most remembered for and helped get New York on board for ratification. Okay, just a few things left here. 47, we've already discussed that a bit, how less democratic this newer government would be compared to the Articles, in the sense that more lawmaking authority is passed at the national level than what used to be at the states, and the states were more in the hands of common voters as opposed to 5/6 of the national government at the top. 48 says the Constitution, despite its undemocratic origins, has grown far more democratic through three methods. The amendments, which have enfranchised people, which turned the Senate into a popular elected body. Court decisions, which have also democratized the government, but also political parties. Political parties democratize the government because as parties realize the more people you enfranchise to vote, the more votes you get, the more power you have to make policy. And our last section to deal with is 49, Bill of Rights themselves. Mainly you'll just need to know these for matching. So a short definition up against a blank with a number is what you'll have to know, but I think they're good to know for more than tennis, they're good to know for life. First Amendment deals essentially with the right of conscience or right to hold opinions and express them, whether they be religious or political. Strong emphasis upon political protection. Founding fathers would not be impressed with things like nude dancing and porn and Grand Theft Auto and that kind of stuff as a First Amendment right. Their concerns were the more political the speech, the more free it should be, because they equated that with a proper check and balance on government authority. First Amendment also bans the establishment of churches, no nationally established religions, but also protects the free exercise thereof. Second Amendment, there was an interesting article today in 14th paper today about a conference being held where they're trying to decide how much more of a role the military should have in disaster situations. And it comes back to that idea of preventing the military being involved where police are already in effect because of the fear of standing armies, going back to the days of the militia times. And so that's not what the article said, or used up the... But
if they weren't looting, the military wouldn't be down there.
If what?
If they weren't a bunch of looting, they wouldn't be down there.
I think what this article was talking about is future circumstances. What should be the future? Whether they have to wait for state approval or whether they should be able to move automatically. A lot of that is not just militia fears. A lot of that came from Civil War circumstances, where in the Civil War, there would be military movements to Indiana and down into Missouri and elsewhere, and who is the authority? Is an authority in power or not, considering the dislocation of the war? Third Amendment, we talked about that. That's related to the quartering acts that came through. Fourth, about search and seizure. Writs of assistance dealt with that. I think the only thing on the Fifth Amendment you might need to be aware of for a definition difference would be the right to not have to testify against oneself and not to be made to stand twice for the same offense trial, which we all know historically does take place when it can be worded properly.
That's what I was going to ask. If, say, you kill somebody and go to trial for it, but they don't have a certain piece of evidence that they find later, and you're not guilty the first time that they find this evidence.
Or worse than that, say after they acquit you, you pull it out and say, here's what you're looking for.
Right.
Yeah.
Can they try you again?
They cannot.
They have new evidence.
They cannot, unless you do it this way. If you're the people that beat Rodney King, and they can't get you on a state charge, they can turn around and say you violated somebody's federal charge rather than a state charge. Or if you're OJ,
yeah, right.
Yes, and they can say a civil case rather than a criminal case. So there's ways to go after the actual same thing, but it has to be done with those kind of technical legal changes. Normally, just new evidence won't do it.
Right, I know there was a movie, Double Jeopardy, with Ashley
Judd. And you know, while we're on this, it seems like if you watch the Dirty Harry movies, and the the Bronson movies, the Death Wish movies, the themes of a lot of these films are to what degree have we coddled criminals so much that our system is making society more unsafe than safe. Well, the original intent of setting up the Bill of Rights was not to allow criminals to escape, it was to do what? Protect the people from a police state. Protect a government that can manufacture evidence over and over to get rid of somebody. Or a government that can force somebody through torture into confessions, which a lot of governments in the world do. So therefore, the Bill of Rights' purpose is ultimately to protect us from the best terrorists on the planet, and that's governments. I don't think the 6th, 7th, or 8th will be on the test. Interesting things, but I don't think they'll be on the test. And if they are, then I'll apologize and know the answer, but I think you know. So we've completed the material. Let me read a couple of sample questions to you, and then I'll give you some numbers here. Here's one. The coercive acts immediately followed the choices include Lexington and Concord battle, Boston Tea Party, Sons of Liberty terrorism towards the Stamp Act, convening of the Second Continental Congress. Which one? Tea Party, yeah. And you would have gotten that without the choices. pretty matter-of-fact stuff. Here's one of them. I won't read the answers, but you'll see where I'm going with this. All the following are provisions of the Paris Peace Treaty of 1783 except. So one of these is going to look good, but be false. The event that convinced the French to come actively into the war against the British on the side of the Americans was? Saratoga victory, yes. Here's one I won't read the answers, but you can get a flavor for it. In conflicts between the states and the national government, according to the Constitution, has superior authority, as indicated by. So that's a fun one. Yeah. Something within the article. All of the following are states that came out of the old Northwest Territory except. States like Virginia and Massachusetts were hesitant to ratify the Constitution until the Bill of Rights added. So it's pretty matter-of-fact stuff. I don't think there's anything tricky on this test. There are 22 multiple choice, 9 chronology set in 3 at a time, and generally on chronology, this one runs real chronological, so you remember which sheet it came on, you know which comes before or after, but you could also protect yourself to a timeline. You started the timeline around 1763 and drew it up to, what, 1788, 87, and put things year by year along that line. Two things would be evident. You'd visually remember where they are, but you'd also might make some connection of cause and effect, which led to what. So things like bills of rights have to come last, wars precede constitutions, articles of confederation precede constitutions, things like that. Some of the matching, there's 2 sets of 5 matching. Some of the matching are amendments, and the other are people. So pretty straightforward stuff. Just memorize everything we circle here, and let's circle these.
So there's about 40 questions.
40 questions worth 2.5 points each. The ghost is still with us. So far, I'm still missing some pages here. Hold on. Let's take a 15-second intermission to talk with ourselves while I hopefully find the first sections of paper.
Circle them on mine.
They're already circled.
Let's circle them all.
Oh,
well,
why?
Set and circle them there.
I have to, I don't know. I have to find my original circle lines here. You're still convening among yourselves rather than staring at me? Okay, good. Okay, I found it. Sorry about that. So, our page 1 says at the top, American Revolution, Articles, Confederation, Constitution, number 1 is the letter to Niles by Adams.
Yes.
Okay, on that page, questions will include number 3, 5, 10, 13, 17, and 18. Next page, which starts with 21. But you don't circle that. You start with 24, 26, 27, 31, 35, and 36. Still missing stuff. Okay, now I found it. Next page that starts off with the sentence, call to unite American public opinion. Okay. Are we on? The next page I'm going to says call to unite American public opinion, one-third, one-third, one-third divide. Yeah. Those include 38, 40, 42, 45. Now the numbers start over at number 1 because it says 1783 to 1789 Articles of Confederation. Okay. On that page, circle 5, 6, 7, 12, and 13.
Which 12?
The second 12. Sorry. Then the next page starts with the number 17, individual states. Okay, circle 17, 21, 23, 27, 28, and 29 through 32. The next page starts with a number 34 saying east dash west. Okay, on that page, circle 36, 41, 45, 46, and the last page, 49, the Bill of Rights.